Third case of the morning is number 023738, Esteban Montano against the City of Chicago. Ms. Pastor.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, federal courts have an unflagging obligation to exercise the jurisdiction conferred upon them by Congress. Here, after tying this case once to an inconclusive result, the District Court simply announced that it would no longer exercise its jurisdiction and would instead wait for the result of Montano's later filed state court proceeding. There is no doctrine that permits District Courts to send cases to state court when they tire of them in this manner. In my remarks this morning, I will explain why the District Court's orders first staying and then dismissing this case, pending the outcome of the state court proceeding, amounted to an abstention of jurisdiction, and second, I will explain why abstention is wholly improper in this case.
I wonder if you could start with a little discussion of why the March 15th order itself, dismissing the federal law claims without prejudice, amounts to a final judgment, given the fact that, you know, we do have quite a few cases that say, you know, that looks an awful lot like the stay that the district court has entered before, one way or the other, by whatever label it's expecting this to come back.
Yes, Your Honor. The dismissal order amounts to an appealable order because it amounts to an abstention. And the reason it amounts to an abstention is because there is a likelihood that the state court judgment will serve as collateral estoppel on Montano's remaining federal law claims. Which is to say,
you're essentially saying it's a Quackenbush appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it's not factually on all fours with Quackenbush.
I understand that. Yes.
But yes, Quackenbush and Moses H. Cohen. Before that.
And if so, I mean, the other question I just wanted to explore on how this gets here is some elaboration on why the city thinks we can look at the September 25 order declining to retain supplemental jurisdiction and whether the November 27 stay order is of any current moment, whether you're barred from complaining about the abstention since you could have complained earlier on the theory that you've just articulated.
Yes, Jenna, I'll start with the second part of your question first. The stay order, of course, is no longer in effect. The dismissal dissolved the stay. And if this court were to reverse the dismissal, as we explained in our briefs, the stay would not sort of pop back into place. Nevertheless, the reason that the stay order is reviewable by this court is that this is not a case, for example, where abstention was proper, but the district court took the wrong form and dismissed the case when it should have stayed the case. Cigna Healthcare would be an example of that. Here, abstention, whether it took the form of a dismissal or a stay, was wholly improper. So for that reason, while we're appealing from the dismissal order, the city district wants to make that point that this is not a case where, you know, it was a technicality that was the error. Here, abstention, whatever form it took, was an abuse of discretion. As for supplemental jurisdiction, we can see that it's not independently appealable. We do argue that it falls under this court's pendant appellate jurisdiction.
So let me ask you this. I mean, in this court's earlier order in this case, which you've appended to your brief at page A3, the March 20, 2002 order describes the district court's order with respect to supplemental jurisdiction as an interlocutory order. Down at the bottom of A4, it says, further, this court has no jurisdiction over defendant's cross-appeal from the district court's interlocutory order abstaining from exercising supplemental jurisdiction. Well, if you're right, and you're taking this final appeal from a final judgment, the March 15 order, then why do you need pendant appellate jurisdiction? Don't all the interlocutory orders come on up with it?
That is the correct, Your Honor.
So why are we worrying about pendant appellate jurisdiction?
Well, pendant appellate jurisdiction comes up when it's in, I got it,
an order is being appealed under the collateral order doctrine.
Collateral order or interlocutory appeals. But if you do have an interlocutory appeal, then pending appellate jurisdiction might be an important thing for us to look into. If you don't have an interlocutory appeal, and if, Joseph, if this other thing was properly characterized as an interlocutory order, then what's the problem?
Well, Your Honor, one answer would be that there is no problem, and that supplemental jurisdiction is reviewable by this court, as all the previous orders of the district court would be. I think the confusion arises because in Quackenbush and Moses H. Cohn, in those cases, the abstention order, they talk about it not as a final judgment, but as a nonetheless appealable order, and those cases generally refer both to an exception to the final judgment rule and the collateral order doctrine.
But don't they cite 1291?
They do, and then they go on to talk about the collateral order doctrine as well.
Well, and the collateral order doctrine is based on 1291. It's effectively final, right?
So, the city, we're just trying to cover all our bases at this point. It's not entirely clear whether these abstention orders are appealable as final judgments, as under the collateral order doctrine. The courts really sort of talk about them as both. And so, you know, if it is a final judgment, then of course, as Your Honor has said, all the previous orders of the district court are reviewable by this court. And we would also argue if it's appealable under the collateral order doctrine, then the supplemental jurisdiction order is reviewable under this court's pendant appellate jurisdiction. We're trying to be very thorough.
Yeah, I just had one other question, really, which is, given the fact that the supplemental jurisdiction order was not reviewed at the time it was entered, whether 54B or whether any vehicle that might have been available, I can't figure out how to put Humpty Dumpty together again in this case, because maybe you could inform us as to what the status of the state court proceedings are. There's no rule that says there can't be parallel state and federal court proceedings, and the Anti-Injunction Act suggests that there's nothing a federal court can do at this stage of the game about stopping the state court proceedings unless the state court wants to do it on its own. I mean, this case is a mess almost any way it comes out.
Yes, Your Honor, we certainly agree that it is a mess. Factually, the state court litigation has been stayed pending the outcome of this appeal. And that case is really in its infancy. Almost nothing has happened in that case in the, I believe, 14 months or so since it's been filed. Your Honor, in this case, all the parties were correctly in federal court to begin with. And supplemental jurisdiction was proper because this is a, under 1367C, this case, certainly the state law and the federal claims, certainly arise out of the same case or controversy. There's one incident, and all the claims, whether they be based on federal or state law, arise out of that incident. So supplemental jurisdiction is certainly proper under 1367A. And the officers and all the parties, indeed, were kicked out of federal court through a series of the district court's orders, and that was highly improper. And it's not that we're trying to get back into federal court, it's that we should have never been kicked out of federal court in the first place. To put the case back together again, as John R. said, the best thing to do would be to reverse the dismissal, for the district court to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claim. And at that point, everything would be back in one forum.
No, it wouldn't dismiss the state court proceeding unless plaintiffs chose to dismiss it.
And the federal courts can't compel.
No, that's my point. I mean, it seems to me, one way or the other, unless there is either some action taken by the state court to continue its stay, perhaps, or to dismiss without prejudice or whatever vehicle it might choose to do, even if we were to do exactly what you just described and reverse the order dismissing the supplemental claims and get them reinstated, we've got two proceedings. That's where we are today. Whether we should have ever gotten there or not is another question, but it is where we are.
As I understand it, I'm sorry, maybe you have an answer from the judge first.
I suppose the best answer is that there is no reason why the two cases can't proceed together, and then the first
court that entered a final judgment, that would obviously serve as collateral estoppel. Well, in some cases it would serve as collateral estoppel, and in some cases it would not. There is a higher standard of proof.
The district court directed out certain claims of the plaintiffs. If we were to follow the scenario that you have just outlined for us, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again that way, what would happen to those claims? Have they really had an opportunity to appeal those claims?
No, Your Honor, they haven't, and those claims are not a final judgment, which, as we point out in our brief, is one of the reasons why none of the district court's rulings on the federal law claims could serve as collateral estoppel in the state court litigation, in addition to this higher standard of proof on the state law claims.
Just as you were not sure as to whether this was a, quote, final, unquote, decision under 1291, and therefore have argued it both as that and as a, quote, collateral order, unquote, could it be possible that the plaintiff was also blindsided by the lack of a Rule 58 judgment and therefore didn't understand that he ought to have appealed or cross-appealed on those claims now?
It's certainly possible, and I wouldn't want to speak for my opponent. But to complete my answer to Your Honor's first question, if the district court were to reassert jurisdiction over the federal law claims, what we would anticipate happening is that the two remaining federal claims on which there's been a mistrial, there would be further proceedings on those. They would go to judgment, and then an appeal could be taken of all the district court's substantive rulings, the summary judgment rulings, the directed verdict rulings, and in addition, whatever happened to the remaining two federal claims.
So you don't think we ought to hold the plaintiffs to downs on the claims that were directed out if we denominate your current posture as having a final decision?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Illinois law, for example, they certainly wouldn't be considered a final judgment. That would you be able to have any kind of preclusive effect in state court.
I'm talking about the claims that were directed out to federal court.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not going to claim that he should have cross-appealed now on those claims?
No, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question related to footnote 14 that you cite in your brief. Isn't there some tension between your argument in that footnote that the order declining supplemental jurisdiction is immediately appealable because it is effectively unreviewable on appeal, and your argument that pendant appellate jurisdiction will promote judicial economy by presenting a second appeal to decide the supplemental jurisdiction issue? Isn't that a little inconsistent?
I'm afraid I don't understand the question.
Well, when you look, in footnote 14, you argue that the order declining supplemental jurisdiction is immediately appealable because it is effectively unreviewable on appeal. Okay, that's on the one hand. And then your argument is that dependent appellate jurisdiction will promote judicial economy by preventing a second appeal to decide the supplemental jurisdiction issue. You don't see any tension in those positions?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because when we say that the order declining supplemental jurisdiction wasn't immediately appealable, that's in and of itself. It only comes up before this court now because we have these subsequent orders, which are either a final judgment or appealable under the collateral order doctrine, which then brings up the supplemental jurisdiction order. And this is clearly an appropriate time to review the supplemental jurisdiction order before things go further down the road, this very complex and confusing road that they've already gone down. This court certainly has jurisdiction to review the supplemental jurisdiction order. It's an appropriate time to do it, and we of course argue that it was wrong. It was an abuse of discretion for the district court to decline supplemental jurisdiction in this case when 1367A certainly permits it. It's the same case of controversy, and none of the exceptions under 1367C that counsel that permit district courts to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction were present. I see. If there are no more questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Baxter. We'll hear now from Mr. Serta.
Uh, Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to first address some of the questions raised by the court. We do not think that this is a final order. There are still pending, two pending federal claims. And if I can correct the position we took in our brief, we took a position that it was clear for the abuse of discretion for the court to dismiss the proceedings in the March order, and because effectively dismissed the case. But it was a dismissal without prejudice, which acts as a stay, and it is an interlocutory order. And we discovered that when reading the appellant's brief citing the case of Jay Foods the Chemical Allied Products 208 3rd at 613. So it's an interlocutory order. With regard to the...
But your opponents made the argument that once you cut through the clutter, if you will, what we have here is functionally abstention. And when a district court will call everything kind of what at this stage of the game a stay, whether under the name of a stay or under the name of a dismissal without prejudice with permission to renew when the state proceedings are over, those kinds of orders, the Supreme Court has told us, are immediately appealable, whether we call them final judgments or whether we call them collateral orders, whatever we want to call them, because the interest in resolving such a fundamental question about which judicial system will hear the case demands an immediate answer. So why isn't the appeal at least secure here under one of these avenues, you know, the final judgment avenue, the Quackenbush, Moses Cone avenue, under something?
Well, I guess we take the position with regard to the stay, that the stay was actually, and that the second order did not change the proceedings. The first stay order stayed the proceedings. There was a dismissal order without prejudice, which is just another stay order. They should have appealed the first stay order.
But,
did not
but
appeal
why?
The first stay order.
Sometimes you can appeal at two different times, and when the district court enters something that says, I'm dismissing the case without prejudice, of course, we don't know if this case will ever be reinstated. There might be a settlement in the state court. There might be a decision in the state court that conclusively rules in favor of the city, and so maybe it will never come back. Many things can happen. I don't see why this isn't one of those instances in which there isn't a singular date on which an appeal has to happen.
Well, it's a unique circumstance that we're in with the second order. Giving the appellee an opportunity to file an appeal on the dismissal order, which is actually a stay order.
But that happens sometimes. It's not the tidiest thing in the world, but we have case law in this court that recognizes that there might be a couple of points at which it's proper to take an appeal, and if that's true, then there's no rigid obligation to take it at the earlier of the times rather than the later.
Well, we did then take the position that the state order was not the entry of the dismissal order, which is the state order, is not an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
Because if we look at the proceedings which are met, we've been talking about the federal claims with a broad brush. Most of the federal claims are dismissed. They're gone. There are only two federal claims pending now, one against Officer Lopez and one against Officer Lampert. There are seven claims in the state court.
Are you conceding that that was correct with respect to the disposition of those federal claims that are gone?
Oh, no.
No,
there's going to be more federal litigation, but it most of it will not be at the trial court level. There was dismissal at the summary judgment level, clear error and abuse of discretion, whatever, with regard to dismissal on Rule 50, Rule 50 motion for judgment in matter of law, or conceded credibility questions of law, they were dismissed anyway. What would happen is that we go to state court, we believe we'll prevail in state court, it's a higher standard. We come back to federal court, there's the two remaining claims, we may decide to litigate them, we may decide not to litigate them, we move for a Rule 54B certification so we can take the whole thing up. We believe, and what's referred to here in the briefs, that at that point the dispute will largely be about attorney's fees, because we will have received a judgment in state court, damages awards to plaintiffs by that jury. The issue will be attorney's fees in the federal litigation. So that what we think the best way to put Humpty Dumpty back together, and I think that it's conceded by the city now that the court doesn't have the authority to tell the state court it cannot proceed with the proceedings, that we that the state remain in place. We will proceed with the state court proceedings and then come back here after those proceedings. With regard to why the state court proceedings are stayed at this point, they were first stayed when plaintiffs took an appeal, thought it was a final order. It wasn't a final order, asked for writ of mandamus. That was declined. Then now the city said that they would appeal the dismissal order, and the city represented that order, that the appeal would then encompass all of the issues, the summary judgment issues, the Rule 50 issues, but that's not what this appeal is about. This appeal is about trying to get to trial on the two remaining federal claims.
But, you know, there's something very disturbing about this, and it's partly because there's a difference between the way reviewability is handled in the removal context and the way it's handled in the supplemental jurisdiction context. If this case had been removed to federal court and the federal court had decided to remand the state claims to the state court, that's, on the whole and by and large, a non-reviewable. You know, it normally doesn't. Actually, you can review some of that, but the point is the statutes spell out how you review that, the statutes plus the Supreme Court's decisions, and when you review it. And in this supplemental jurisdiction context, we don't have that. And what concerns me is that if it was, at the outset, a clear error under 1367 to dismiss the supplemental claims, if it was something like what happened in one of the removal cases where the district judge says, I just don't want to be bothered with these state claims, when the parties had a right under the supplemental jurisdiction statute to have them in federal court, then that's very troubling. And to allow that initial error to structure the entire rest of the litigation is also very troubling.
I understand the court's position.
I'm offering it to you as a thought. It's a complicated case.
Yeah, that's what's been done. Again, the defendants could have appealed in November.
How could they have appealed the supplemental jurisdiction ruling without getting a 1292B certification?
Because
or perhaps, well, not even a 54B. It doesn't qualify as 54B if it's just been dismissed without prejudice for it to be pursued in state court. That's not a final judgment in favor of anybody.
They could have appealed, I think, at the point where the stay was issued, they could have appealed based on the their Quackenbush.
But how could they have appealed the supplemental jurisdiction ruling earlier? Maybe you're familiar with some. I've looked at a lot of supplemental jurisdiction appeals, and the ones I found, occur after there's a final judgment, and then somebody says, you shouldn't have dismissed the supplemental claims. I can't find a case that looks quite like this one.
And nor could we, and it's an odd procedural position, but we do think that there is a way out of the quagmire that we're in, and that's just proceeding with the state court claims.
But then why wouldn't everybody do this all the time who doesn't want to be in federal court on state claims and sever and have duplicate litigation when it's actually very much the same facts with slightly different standards of proof that will be considered by both tribunals?
Well, essentially, I think looking at the case from a perspective of judicial economy, you have to take into consideration that there are, at one point, there were 21 parties, actual parties. There are 50 may-call or will-call witnesses, at least on each side.
No, I understand. You're telling me about this case, and we have certainly an obligation with respect to this case, but I'm wondering about every case that follows after today. If a district court gets a complaint, that raises both federal and state claims, decides he or she doesn't want to bother with the state claims, and then just dismisses them, that's not a scenario that is supposed to happen under the supplemental jurisdiction statutes. And I want to know how one addresses that, how one prevents that kind of abuse.
I think with the discussion and a written opinion from this court would instruct, I think, the judges perhaps not to engage in that practice.
Mm-hmm.
This was a sua sponte. The defendants didn't ask for this. Plaintiffs didn't ask for this. I mean, we're very surprised as we were listening to the summary judgment, that the opinion being read, that those counts have been dismissed. But this is a unique case, and we're in this position now, and we're trying to work our way out of it. But the best way would allow me to continue with the state court proceedings, because with the federal court proceedings, we're still going to have to assemble the parties and the witnesses to try really just two claims. And then we'd have to come, and we submit that there are some glaring, that the Rule 50 dismissals will not stand, and the summary judgment dismissals, likewise, decided credibility issues and or legal issues erroneously, that will not stand. We'll come back for a second. We've already assembled part of the group one time. We'd assemble a second time for the trial of the two defendants, and we'd have to do it a third time. But we think at this point we can get it all done with one state court trial, because that will cover the primary defendants in this case. As the defendants recognize, that would be res judicata. If the Seventh Circuit decides in our favor on the Rule 50 decision and some of the summary judgment decisions, and that's the best way we think to put Humpty Dumpty back together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sir. Ms. Pastor, you have 1 minute.
Very briefly, Your Honors. The key here is not judicial economy. The key is the defendant's right to have their federal law claims asserted against them tried in a federal forum. The abstention in this case was clearly an abuse of discretion. There is no doctrine that permits abstention over federal law claims in favor of a later filed state court proceeding in this manner, particularly where the state court proceeding could serve as collateral estoppel and be the basis for attorney fees under federal law. This case was filed in federal court. The defendants had a right, continue to have a right, to a federal forum. And for those reasons, we ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Pastor. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for their fine